Hello.
Hey, what's up, Jason?
Nothing. Just nothing. It's wonderful. Just
nothing. Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Been cutting back a lot of things in my life and
back down all the way to nothing, I see.
Yeah. Pretty much, no. Just trying to work and trying to read more.
Reading anything good?
I'm reading a book on, I don't know how to pronounce it, that startup that did like the blood testing.
Oh, yeah. That's got to be fun.
Yeah, the book's called Bad Blood. Fantastic name.
I've heard of that. Yeah. Is it good?
It's really good. I'm like, so it's the book I've been reading before I go to bed. I'm like 50% through and like I'm hooked. Like I like hate that I get tired and like want to fall asleep.
I felt that way with American Kingpin, I think was the name. And that's the one about the Silk Road guy where he was, you know, selling drugs and hiring hitmen and stuff. That's all for Bitcoin. Cool. It's a really good book. Have you read the David Goggins book?
No.
Oh, man. That one's really good. I'll have to send it to you. I'll put a link in the notes too. That one I read a month ago or something on a trip and was like just totally hooked. And then one of my friends who has been reading it lately, and like I'll get messages in Slack randomly that are like, oh my God, this book, like, do you remember this story that happened? And I'm like, oh, I might need to reread that again. It was really good.
That's awesome. I've not been much of a reader in my life, but I am social media-less for the first time since MySpace. And so I'm trying to, like, instead of filling that time with like more TV, trying to fill it with reading. And so I've been reading.
That's good.
Yeah. It's something.
I when I got into reading a lot more was when I picked up Audible. Like, it's not really reading in the normal sense, but, you know, like, especially when I lived in New York City and had a 45-minute commute back and forth to the office.
Oh, yeah.
I'd read, you know, several books a week sometimes if they were shorter ones. So, yeah, I really, really enjoy that. But now that I work from home, I don't commute anywhere, so I don't get near as much of that. So I think I need to start going on walks or something in the middle of the day to get a break and, you know, read something.
Yeah. So, I tried the Audible thing when I was walking earlier this year, and I must have just like chosen the wrong books because I was just like so bored on my walk. But that's when I switched to listening to like the Honey Badger podcast. What's that called? Founder Quest.
Yeah, Founder Quest. Yeah.
So I started listening to that, and I don't know. Maybe I just need to pick more entertaining books for.
Yeah, Don't try and listen to a programming book on Audible.
CLASS space.
Yeah. Semicolon space. Parentheses. Close parentheses.
I can't even read. Like when I first got into like reading programming books, I would like buy the Kindle version and it was just like a train wreck because like trying to format code with like,
oh yeah,
I don't know. I don't know how to describe it. It was like just reading a bunch of like characters that were foreign to me. So
yeah, it's definitely, I don't know. It's hard to do that, especially when stuff changes too, like, you know, programming languages and formats and whatever all are changing. So trying to write a book on programming stuff is only going to be valid for X number of years at most.
Yeah, I look at the books on my shelf, and like a couple of them I think will serve me. Like one of them is actually like a book on Scheme. So like it can't get any older or any more out of date. But the rest of them I kind of look at like, yeah, these will like end up at a McKay's Books for like $5 in 5 years. So,
oh, yes. So,
well, we are, as kind of per usual the last year, not alone. We have a guest with us today, Jason Meller. Jason, do you mind just saying hey and giving a brief introduction?
Hey guys, thanks for having me. I appreciate that you guys had me on. with the name confusion going on. I think that was pretty brave of you. So, yeah, my name is Jason Meller. I'm the founder and CEO of a company called Collide. And basically, Collide is a Slack app, and it messages your employees when their laptops aren't following security best practices or policy. And we try to do that instead of encouraging customers to lock down devices and kind of make it really lame. We want people to use their devices to their pure potential. And we want just to have that right balance between privacy, between security, and the freedom to use your computers. And that's what we're all about. But as for me, I've been sort of a little bit of everything. Like, I started off, you know, just being psyched about computers and the web, going all the way back to the early 90s. And I started learning Ruby and Rails at around the same time in around 2009. And I've been pretty psyched about building web apps in Rails ever since. So that's pretty much me in a nutshell.
That's awesome. So Collide, what kind of, just going to jump in here, what kind of led you into building an app like that?
So I've been in the cybersecurity industry ever since I graduated from college. I actually got my first gig out of college at General Electric. And I wasn't even like a computer science major or anything like that. I was actually a business major. And I got into GE's corporate, you know, management training program. And what they actually have you do, which is kind of weird looking back on it, is every 6 months they have you move to a different part of the country. Because at the time, GE was everywhere. You know, they owned NBC, they had appliances, you know, aviation, healthcare. And so you'd go all over the country and you'd like stay in a certain part of it for 6 months and you kind of help them solve a problem. And then they'd punt you off somewhere else 6 months later. Well, one of those rotations ended up being security related. And it was really cool, at least for me, not cool for GE, because at the time they were, you know, working with a lot of Department of Defense contractors. They were working on pretty awesome stuff with the Joint Strike Fighter, and a lot of advanced threat actors from China and Russia were also really interested in what GE was doing. So what we ended up doing was actually building an internal security capability there. And I get to be a part of that, where we basically had to detect threats across hundreds of thousands of systems and, you know, really kind of look at that from that perspective. But while I was on the team, I was kind of responsible for intelligence. And what I ended up learning was pretty much I really like building tools for my fellow team members more than I like doing the work itself. So what I ended up actually doing was building my first Ruby on Rails app on that team, and actually helped them kind of get organized with all the intelligence that they were kind of collecting across all the threat actors that we were tracking. And I found an opportunity outside of GE at a company called Mandiant. And we were sort of known as like the cybersecurity company that you would call when you were, you know, owned by these really advanced threat actors. So I got to move into more of on the vendor side of the equation and actually build apps for a living. And everywhere I pretty much went, I kind of took Ruby on Rails with me. I was usually building an app there, and I got to kind of put together a small team and build a really awesome app and then do it over and over again. And it ended up working out really well. In about 2016, though, I realized that I was doing this a lot for other companies, and I realized I was kind of really doing everything. Like, I kind of was conceptualizing the app. I was putting together the team, you know, helping the marketing and sales team actually sell it. And I was like, I think I could do this myself. And what we ended up doing was I ended up leaving Mandiant, which at the time ended up being acquired by another company called FireEye. So we were at FireEye. And I saw that Facebook had actually just released this open source endpoint security agent. And it was awesome. And I wanted to build sort of, they just had released the agent part, the part that actually goes on the device itself. But no one had built a really good UI or management experience on top of that. So I was like, I feel like there's something to be had here about creating like a really transparent agent that was completely open source and then kind of trying to build a commercial solution on top of that. So I thought that was interesting. That was sort of the genesis of starting Collide in 2016. we learned a lot since then. You can't really build a business just like taking an open source project and like building a pretty UI on it. You can definitely get some customers, but at the end of the day, you really need to solve an actual problem. So it really actually took us several years to really kind of get our footing and understand where we could add value. And all the experiences I had along the way, you know, kind of growing up in the cybersecurity industry, I sort of never really sat right to me how I had to do my job, which was primarily based on surveilling end users, like kind of figuring out, you know, what they were doing on the network, what they were doing on their devices. That always felt a little creepy to me. And the second thing I really didn't like about the cybersecurity industry that I sort of want to change is that end users really aren't brought into the loop. They're sort of, you know, considered the security risks. And at the end of the day, they're not really considered a priority in terms of educating as to why certain things are more dangerous than others. And that's sort of like, you know, the lowest budgetary item in the security budget for most companies is actually educating end users. So what we realized at Collide was that we could actually start thinking about how we could take companies that had really good cultures and they were a little nervous about getting into security and like kind of adding security to the stack of things they were thinking about because they didn't want to hurt their culture of, you know, personal responsibility and freedom and having their employees be able to do what they need to do to get their job done. And we felt like we could fill a niche there and actually have them have a security solution that would allow them to meet their compliance standards, make their customers happy, but also kind of preserve the culture that they have going on in their organization. That's sort of what the genesis of Collide really was. When we founded the company in 2016, the Facebook sort of tie-in where, you know, Facebook actually had created this agent, deployed it all across this infrastructure. That was like a net positive for us. It was great from a branding perspective to have like that incredible company with this scale, like kind of proving out this open source agent. But now in like 2019, with all the privacy concerns, Facebook actually became a liability because people are like, wait, this was created by Facebook and it's like sitting on my computer. But what's great about open source is that, you know, the community can scrutinize it. And recently Facebook actually transferred ownership of OSQuery, the agent that we built our solution on, to the Linux Foundation, which is really exciting. So yeah, I know that was kind of a meandering answer, but that's sort of what kind of got me excited about starting Collide. First, it started off almost like a technical opportunity. And then what was really a technical opportunity turned into, let's actually change how this is done and let's build a solution for the companies that, you know, if I was building another company that wasn't in the security industry, that I would want to build from a culture perspective.
That's super cool. I, like, when I was in school, loved kind of application security and was kind of exploring going down that path. But I don't know, at some point I was like, I need to learn first, obviously, how to build applications before I dive into more of that. But I feel like a lot of the Rails community doesn't understand that Ruby is so popular in security stuff, because one of the biggest Ruby projects probably in the world is Metasploit, which is used all over the place.
Yeah, absolutely. The Ruby community to me has always been really, I always felt like it's had, especially even in Rails, like it's always had a really good foundational start with security. And I think a lot of the work that, you know, Jeremy Dare has done at Basecamp to really kind of support the latest and greatest in terms of like browser technology around security and, you know, supporting CSRF protection out of the box and stuff like that. It's really makes it like the right framework for us to work in and really kind of preserve our reputation.
Yeah. And I know you mentioned before this that you guys have kind of, you know, followed the same footsteps too, like trying to build the app with things like TurboLinks and Stimulus. Like, how's it been building a new SaaS product on Rails?
So I mentioned that we kind of had to reset a few times, and we did our last big reset from an app perspective at the beginning of this year. So this year is sort of in February is sort of when we made that decision that, you know, we wanted to kind of look at this more niche part of, you know, what I call user-focused security, and we wanted to build an app around that. So we got to really kind of pick everything from scratch. So when you decide to build a new SaaS app in 2019, you know, I think if you were like on Hacker News, like asking for like, what are the right technologies to do that? You know, people are going to spout off a list of things that are really popular right now. But in the past, at Collide, that we actually experimented with and had a lot of velocity issues with, like, you know, using Go for building web apps was really challenging for us in the past before we switched to Rails. We had, you know, a full React SPA, and just finding the right expertise to do that, and just the amount of velocity that can be lost if you kind of create too many components too early was really like a big bummer. And a lot of the decisions that we were making was out of this weird fear of Rails not being able to scale, because we have both people kind of hitting our web app, you know, through their browser, but we also have these devices that are checking in over HTTPS as well. And we were worried, you know, can we really handle both of those streams of traffic in a monolithic Rails app? Well, it turns out that, you know, a Rails app in 2019 is a perfectly fine choice. And what was really cool was we decided to kind of start the app over when the Rails 6 beta had first landed. And so we got to kind of start from that beta, right when those, you know, new action text framework was just merged in and the other framework, all that stuff had just happened. And we got to really kind of get a lot of things fixed early on in the process. So when Rails 6 final came out a month ago, we just had to pretty much upgrade the drum and do nothing else, which was awesome. But at the end of the day, we really needed something. We needed velocity because we were rewriting our app and we needed to do that quickly. And we needed something that a small team could work on. And I don't know about you guys, like when you start a new Rails app, like the thing that I do first is I sort of like ensconce myself in like the teachings of DHH, right? I'll like listen to a bunch of interviews and podcasts, and I'll like freeze frame like a bunch of code he's working on YouTube to kind of figure out, okay, what's like the latest way to kind of get my project organized and like take some of those DHH-isms and bring them to a similar web app. So there was a lot of that going on like early January and stuff. And that's how I like discovered Stimulus.js. And that was like a really great, you know, I'd say compromise between, you know, really going crazy from like a React component perspective, but on the other side, like not having jQuery spaghetti soup on the other side. So Stimulus ended up working out really well for us. And when it comes down to it, most web apps really don't have that many stateful components. Like we ended up only having two or three things in the app. Like, and I'm talking about like buttons or like a section of a sidebar that really needed that level of state management where we were like, oh, React really would have helped us here. But beyond those like very small cases, we just ended up seeing it. And then on the scaling side, we now have thousands of devices checking into the product, and we're serving on the device server about 250 requests per second on Heroku, and we're not seeing this thing really break a sweat, and we don't have a lot of complicated backend infrastructure. And, you know, wouldn't you know it, Postgres is actually pretty good at saving data and actually retrieving it later. Like you don't have to like assume those things won't scale, because they will, a lot farther than I think most people assume they will. So we've had a lot of success, and we're really psyched to be in the Rails community even in 2019 and in good company with like GitHub and Shopify and all those guys who really kind of proving it out.
Yeah, there's so many times you hear people talk about Rails doesn't scale, but it's like, well, have you used GitHub or Shopify or Netflix? Like they're all using Rails and they're all doing just fine. But when, especially when you think about things too, with like devices checking in, you can imagine, well, if we have 100,000 devices at some point, that might be something you're worried about, but you also have the expertise of Heroku and their scaling of Postgres and Dynos and everything. And they've done a lot of this before, so you can trust much of that to them, which is awesome.
Yeah, I'm also interested in what you're talking about, like going from just tons of React components to like less stateful components. And that's kind of a thing like I've like weaved in and out of in the last couple of years. Because like as I was finishing up at my last job, like they were moving a lot towards React, and that like they still are, and like GraphQL and things like that. And it was really cool. Like it was my first exposure to that. And then I came to my next company and they had just started really, like, stimulus had just been released and they were really kind of early adopting it. And we've just used stimulus like you wouldn't believe. But, like, I'm starting a new project that is very stateful. And so, like, I'm like, I could see where, like, stimulus could turn into essentially, like, a modern version of jQuery, like, spaghetti. So, I don't know. It's just kind of nice to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, it really comes down to it's, like, the right tool for the right job. And, you know, everybody says this is almost like a, you know, deriding Rails in some place. Like, well, if you're not building something like Basecamp, then, you know, it really might not be the best choice. And I think that applies to Stimulus as well. You know, Stimulus is very much homegrown framework for a lot of the types of interactions that you can have in Basecamp. That being said, there's a lot of interactions that you can have in Basecamp if you've ever used the product that, you know, they do feel like, oh, maybe React would have been the right choice here. But there's just not enough to justify using this React sledgehammer across the app. Because there's, you know, in my opinion, there's just a lot of cognitive overhead that you get, that you add by just simply, you know, creating just like your first two React components and really thinking about interleaving that into your app. Like as soon as you've kind of broken that seal and you're like, okay, we're now importing this React dependency, and suddenly it's just the cognitive overhead, I think, goes up by an order of a magnitude. And you have to be very cognizant of that. And you have to be very, I don't know, you just have to be, you have to make that decision deliberately and not just be like, assume that that's the right tech because everybody else has sort of gotten there eventually. And we've seen time and time again, you know, technology that's very promising that was taken up by the greater community kind of fall out of favor 3 or 4 years later. And, you know, 5-6 years ago, people really would have been pushing something else like Ember or even going all the way back to like Backbone.js and stuff like that. Like everybody, I've talked to anybody who has like a legacy app that's 1-6 years old and they feel kind of like they missed the boat on what they were working on. And the JavaScript community just changes so much that, you know, from my perspective, I just want to minimize that amount that I'm really spending like quote unquote innovating on that front. I really am building. At the end of the day, it's a web app. People need to view text and images on a screen. They need to have some light level of interactivity. Let's just try to keep it simple and not like elevate the front end like it's this incredible platform for the use cases that we're using for. It's just like a window where you can view some text and see some images and click a few radio buttons and click on a submit button and stuff happens. Like, I think if you try to turn it into like it's, you know, we're creating, you know, these incredible science fiction interfaces where everything's like up, flying around and up to date. We're going to add WebGL to the mix. It's just, I don't know. It just feels like that really doesn't match the majority of business SaaS apps or even consumer SaaS apps that I see in the wild.
Yeah. One thing about our approach is like Stimulus, we will still like continue to use it. Like we're not going to, this one project, we may not even end up with React on it, but like that's where I'm starting. But it's not like from day one, it's like, let's just do everything in React. It's like, hey, we've made it very far. This might be a good use case for this. Let's kind of like just slightly introduce it. And that's one thing that like I really do like about like React and Vue is that you don't have to go like full like single page app to adopt it. You can kind of just introduce components here and there within your just server rendered Rails page. And I don't know, it's something I really like.
Yeah, I've mixed and matched both in the same app. And there's a big context switch when I have to jump into like a Vue component for something. But when I do have something that's really more complicated than I really want to do in Stimulus, it works, you know, pretty well just to have the one confined feature that kind of needs it, but use Stimulus everywhere else that, you know, is a little more simple. Like those little, I don't know, little form things where you need to trigger your even payments or something, but like triggering a button to disable and say processing for a little bit. Like those things don't need to be written in Vue or React or whatever. It's a heavy-handed right. approach. And there was, I don't know if you guys have seen, but Laravel community has Inertia.js, which is kind of a fun mixture of like without going the full single page app route and having like separate apps, they have your backend like Rails or Laravel actually render the components instead of your normal template. But then they will like, I think it's, they serialize the JSON into the template as props. So you can kind of skip some of the like state management stuff, which I thought was kind of cool. But it's like, you know, everybody seems to be trying to work backwards now from, you know, single page apps to, hold on a second, how do we get something that's still more server controlled, you know, that isn't quite so heavy, but can still be, you know, more complex if needed. So I bet this just changes a lot in the next, you know, 5 years again, as it has in the previous five. I was curious about, would you explain kind of how OS query works? I know we talked about it a while back when we met and stuff. And I think like it's just such a cool thing that you can, well, I'll give you the reins to give the introduction for it. You'll explain it better than I will.
Well, I agree. It's really cool. And basically the best way to talk about OS queries, it's this sort of way to sort of turn your device and all the things inside your device and the components of your device into a relational database that you can query with real SQL. So like you look at a standard laptop, it has hardware, it has a BIOS, it has an operating system, it has files, processes are running. All these concepts can be represented as virtual tables with columns. And in OS query, you can select them just like you can real tables in a real, you know, Postgres or SQLite database. So with OS query, I can actually just kind of run the daemon or run the command line interface, and I can actually go and get a SQLite prompt and then type stuff like select star from apps, and it'll actually enumerate all the apps on my computer. Now, that's really powerful because, first of all, it runs across Mac, Linux, and Windows. So you get some level of normalization. So if I do things like select star from processes, no matter what operating system I'm on, I'm going to get some normalized information, like a process is a process. It has a PID, it has a path, and I can now run this query across multiple devices and really get some semblance of the same information back, which is really great. But the other cool thing is it really is real SQL and real tables in the sense that you can join them together. You can add, you know, really complex conditions. And the way that it actually works under the hood is really cool. So they just took SQLite, and SQLite basically has these hooks where you get to define how it actually, the query parser actually goes and pulls data from what normally is like a, you know, a SQLite file. But instead of you can kind of override that functionality and actually convert these virtual tables into API calls against the real operating system. So when I do things like select star from, you know, processes, it's not like pulling it from a cache or something like that. It's actually converting that into the API calls native to that platform to pull that information in real time. And you can see that really easily if you do something like select star from time, which will just pull the local time of the computer. And every time you run it, of course, it's up to date. So that's really it in a nutshell, is it allows you to do that. And it has like a really cool remote API and a daemon so that you can interact with it remotely. And just with that very basic premise, you can do a lot of cool detection stuff with it. But with that sort of awesome capability, what we found is that you also have to build, when you're building like an experience on top of that core capability, you need to be really cognizant about user privacy and things like that so that you're not overly collecting information beyond the scope of your detection mission as well. So that's been a really big focus for us. Is this is a really cool tool, but how can we assure that it's being used in a really legitimate fashion for a proper detection, security detection strategy?
So have you guys built something like Active Record on top of that?
Yes. I think that actually I've never used that analogy. I don't know how well I would play with customers because not many of them know what Active Record is, but yeah, actually, that is kind of what we do. What we found was, I'll kind of take you back to 2016 and 2017. The first theory of what was going to make us successful as a business was all we had to do was take this incredible capability and let's just make a giant SQL box that you could like log into, type some SQL commands in there, and then hit run, and all the results stream in real time from all your devices, like live query across all your devices. Wouldn't that be awesome? And we built it, and people were like, whoa, this is really neat. Like, if I ever have a question about any of my devices, I can just type in some SQL here and I can get the answer. But what we found is in practice, it's number one, people have a really hard time writing more than like basic SQL. It's really hard for them to conceptualize like what the joins need to be and things like that. The second thing that we found though, is that people had the same questions over and over about their device. Like they want to know, is the firewall enabled? Well, on a Mac, there's like eight places you need to look to like actually determine if that's the case. You got to look at these plists, you know, is the Mac being used under like mobile device management? If so, let's check these policies and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And are we talking about like a user specific preference or like a global preference across the entire operating system? So there's all this like built-in domain knowledge that you need to like actually query the device properly to arrive at a conclusion. So people really struggled with that, and they would actually draw incorrect conclusions from the data that we were providing, which is, you know, the worst case scenario. So instead of really doing that, it's like, okay, can we do all the legwork for them? Can we utilize this agent and actually start pulling together more higher level information and deriving conclusions from the device versus all this raw data and sort of giving it to you to kind of figure out what's actually going on? Can we actually determine definitively that the firewall is turned off? Can we determine definitively that you have full disk encryption? Can we determine definitively that macOS is up to date? And those are the types of things that we do now in our current product, is we do a lot of that legwork for you. Like, how can you convert a macOS serial number and turn that into like the friendly Mac product name? And what does that product laptop even look like as like an image? Like, those are the questions that people just have. And then you can actually predict what they are. And if you can present it to them and then make that information more accessible, that's even more valuable than OS query on its own.
That is awesome. So you guys are now kind of focused around Slack on interacting with this, or is it online too?
Yeah. So I basically, when I describe the company, I describe it as a Slack app. And the reason why is a lot of the customers that we're trying to entice into our platform are companies that, as I mentioned earlier, they really care about culture. So these are companies that typically are other SaaS providers themselves. They have a lot of software engineers and they already have a security solution, or they're kind of reaching the point in their business growth where they need to start thinking about it. Like, their customers are asking them a bunch of security related questions. Are you compliant with this? What do you guys do to kind of ensure your devices are kept up to date, or how do you find malware? And they're looking at all the existing security solutions out there and they're a little nervous. And the reason why is a lot of those are, first of all, not really tailored to that type of customer. They're tailored to big Fortune 500s, mostly Windows-based, and they're, you know, kind of like combination antivirus and like advanced threat actor detection. And they're very much tailored to the interests of the security team, which is about how much information can we collect, and not really thinking about the performance implications of the devices itself. And then finally, they have concerns about locking down devices at all and then actually hurting the productivity of their engineers. Like, a story that I was talking with a customer a few months ago, and they were telling me about how they had MDM deployed in their environment, you know, like Apple's mobile device management. And they were like, all right, we need to make sure disk encryption's on, the firewall needs to be on, SIP, you know, system integrity protection needs to be configured. So we're going to just turn all those things on because having them off is not right. Like, it's not about having that choice. It's just wrong if you don't have those things on and ready to go. So what ended up happening was one engineer stopped getting some stuff done. Like, they weren't getting anything done for like 3 or 4 days. And when they dug into it, they realized that the engineer was like, well, I'm waiting for this ticket to be resolved from IT. And it turns out this engineer couldn't connect to their like internal, like their local Docker daemon. Like, they were trying to connect to Docker and it just wasn't working. And then they were like, oh, I don't know why it's not working. So they went to like their system preferences. They looked at their firewall settings and they noticed it was the firewall was turned on and they couldn't turn it off. Like the button was grayed out. So instead, so what they did was like, well, that's the reason the firewall's on and I can't fix this. So I'm just going to have to like see what the IT team can do. So eventually the IT team, after like a day or two of like lag time and them looking at the request, they were like, all right, well, this person doesn't necessarily have to have the firewall on if they needed to connect to Docker. So they allowed him to turn the firewall off. So he turns it off. And this is like 72 hours later. And it turns out he still can't connect to his Docker daemon. And it was a totally different problem. And that's like the story we keep hearing over and over again is like, as a software engineer, you really do need the ability to really turn on and off security features to do your job. Like you're creating unsigned binaries, you need to be able to turn off Gatekeeper to make that happen. Or you're building a kernel extension, so I need to turn off system integrity protection. But the key is like you need to be able to turn it back on. You need to be able to remember to do that. But forcing it to be on at all times is not necessarily the right answer. And it can really hamper productivity. It can just kind of make you feel kind of blah about the whole thing. And then before you know it, you're bringing in a personal device and you're using that instead. And you have a whole nother slew of security problems. So this is something that we keep hearing from these types of organizations. And so what we do is we simply allow you to define a security policy. Like we want to make sure all these things are on. And then when the engineer maybe turns them off, after a few hours, we'll just, you know, have a little hand on their shoulder and say, hey, did you know your firewall's still off? Maybe you want to turn that back on. And we do that over Slack. And in the Slack app itself, we can actually have these really interactive experiences where they can be like, oh, okay, I turned it back on. Like I fixed it, like check again. And then we could, through the Slack app, reach out to their device in real time and like verify that they actually did it. So it's really powerful because we can have that back and forth communication. But really where it gets really exciting is that beyond management, like kind of as a replacement for management, we can also find stuff that really doesn't make sense for management at all, like unencrypted credentials. So like developers, and this is something that I'm like a huge fan of, is like empathetic security, where you kind of can put your mind into the mind of the person who really is doing the development or, you know, working on the device, and you can really kind of take some educated guesses about some things that they're likely to not do correctly that can generate risk for the organization. And it's all the same stuff. And you can just kind of apply your own experiences to those and really get really accurate detection as a result. So like some of the stuff that we look for is like, oh, here's a user that has some unencrypted SSH keys. And this one says US East production. You know, possibly maybe that shouldn't be in their personal Dropbox folder, like syncing all over the place. Or like, oh, this person has, you know, G Suite or Gmail, and they have two-factor enrolled. Well, it looks like they just saved like the two-factor backup codes in their downloads folder. You know, maybe those shouldn't be in there. Oh, they have 1Password and their 1Password recovery PDF is on their desktop. Or like, oh, this person needed to take a backup of the production database so they can help troubleshoot a problem. But now it's like 3 months later and it's like still there and their disk isn't encrypted. So maybe we want to take care of that. So like those are the types of things where you can really kind of see the pathway where these massive compromises can happen. And if you can help an engineer kind of head that off at the pass with just some gentle reminders and some education about why you should do those things, that's way more effective, in my opinion, than just totally locking down their device and not even like telling them why they can't access certain things.
Man, it brings back so many memories of times where, you know, I would have the production database, you know, as a copy on my machine, or all of us would, and, you know, some smaller projects where we'd just like, oh, we'll just sync it down and then we can reproduce the error and whatever. Like, then it just gets left there for years or whatever because you didn't clean it up or whatever. There's so many times that, you know, we've done bad things like that in the past. I'm sure we all have. So are you guys using like the Slack, like don't they have the webhooks API and then like a real-time integration? Are you doing both of those, or how does your app work to connect with Slack?
Yeah, so the old school way, or maybe not old school is the wrong word, but like maybe the lighter touch way to interact with Slack was through sort of like a dedicated, like, you know, registered webhook. But sort of the new thing to do now is to really register this explicit app that has, you know, very specific OAuth permissions, and it has the ability to like funnel these events in and then, you know, delegate them to various routes in your application. And what Slack recently, we got very lucky because at the time that we decided to build this, Slack had just released sort of this block builder messaging template, you know, capability where they came up with a completely new way for actually building these Slack messages in sort of these composable blocks. And that was really fun because we kind of have to figure out, a big part of our app is talking to the end user and also like allowing our customers to inject their own voice and like build their own templates. So we had to kind of figure out a way to make it really easy for our customers to modify the messages or make their own, like using something like Markdown, and then convert that into the Slack sort of fake version of Markdown or a limited version of Markdown that they have, and then sort of inject that into these like composable blocks that have all these different interactions, and we're passing all these sort of references and IDs. And what's so funny is we sort of have that aspect, and it very much, when we actually got done with it, it very much looked like a very simplified version of a Rails app, except instead of dealing with, you know, web application requests, we were really dealing with Slack messages, and we had basically a controller, and we basically had a view for rendering these partials, which were these block messages. And then we're like maybe we should eventually refactor this to actually just use the standard Rails controllers and views to actually bring all this together, because that's sort of where we ended up landing anyway. So very much to me follows this MVC pattern, and it was really awesome to build and then to get our app actually approved and available in their directory. It took us only a few weeks to really do that, and it was a lot of fun, and they have a lot of great documentation around it.
Cool. I think my integrations have mostly been pretty straightforward. Like, you can type in our Slack, if we're GoRails, you can type / GoRails and then a query, and then it will search the episodes and suggest something. But I could definitely see is building that, like, because they offer a lot of really nice interactive like buttons and other ways to, you know, create a message that you can interact with. I could definitely see that feeling like you're not necessarily writing a HTML response, but it's very similar and kind of spitting out the same output there, just so you can integrate and, you know, create buttons and selects and whatever. And most of those all link back to the website to actually, you know, go more in depth, or can you do a lot of stuff just right in Slack itself?
Yeah, you know, as much as I'd love them to hit the web app, the reality is most people want to just get through the messages, because it's not like we're messaging you to have a party. It's like we're here to, you know, somewhat annoy you. And we try to keep that to a minimum, but that's the reality of what we are. So we try to do it as much as possible in the Slack app. And that's really where the power of some of these new capabilities in Slack has really panned out, because we don't necessarily have to fall back to like a web app experience to do one or two things. A good example of that is like this, I fixed it, like check again button. So they can click that and our app will receive that they click that button and, you know, hit a, you know, create a sidekick job to then like run a live query on their device. And then we'll check to see if they actually, you know, encrypted the SSH key or like deleted the, you know, plain text two-factor codes. And we'll make a determination about that. And if they did, we can actually update the report card that they get in real time. So we can actually go back to messages that we've already emitted and update their status based on interactions that they've had subsequently with the app. And that's really, really powerful, is being able to kind of take these little blocks and replace the contents of existing messages that you've sent. And with that base level capability, you can really build something that feels way more like an app than like just a string of immutable text messages. And that was really tough for us, especially me, because like I grew up in the IRC days where chat is, you know, the way that chat works was very much cemented in my head. You know, you have just strings of messages, and the way that you interact with bots is very much like this known UX pattern. But with Slack, there's just so much that you can do beyond that, you know, beyond the framework of just assuming once a message is emitted, it can never be changed. Once you've sort of knocked down that wall, anything can really be possible. You can really build these dynamic changing screens that don't necessarily have to pollute their entire chat history. And you can probably see that today with like a lot of the GitHub integrations and stuff. When you have like CI running, you'll notice like in real time, it's like updating the colors from like red to yellow to green. And a lot of that stuff is really cool instead of just emitting messages over and over again.
That's awesome. There's one thing I do want to kind of shift gears back to kind of to the beginning. You had mentioned Basecamp and like some of their approaches to security. And in some of our correspondence before the podcast, you said you actually spoke with them about some security stuff. Do you have anything you're allowed to share out of that conversation?
Yeah, they were great. They didn't make me sign an NDA or anything. And what basically happened was I got a copy of Jason Fried's and DHH's new book, like It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work. And this was like October of last year. So almost a year ago. And I read, like, there was one part of it where they're like, oh, we put our entire employee handbook on GitHub. And I was like, oh, I bet you that's really interesting to read. So I like hopped over on GitHub. I'm like, let's see what they kind of give to their employees from like a culture handbook perspective. So I took a peek in there, and there was all these references to this project and hyperlinks as well that would 404 for this thing called Shipshape. And they kept talking about how, you know, their culture was very much about trusting their employees to do their job and not creating a culture of surveillance or creating like this pressure to perform during specific hours of the day. Like, let's give you the freedom to really get your job done. And we expect you to get that job done, but we're not going to tell you how to do it or when to do it. I really like that. But what they had to do in order to make that culture reality is they had to start building some of their own tools. And they built this thing called Shipshape. And basically what Shipshape is it's this sort of, it's based on this, I think it's like a bash testing framework. So basically, you know, there's like a bunch of like bash commands or bash tests that, or shell commands that, you know, they're trying to run to verify that the machines are configured correctly. And I can't quite remember if the end users have to run them themselves or they somehow run automatically. But basically, these tests run, and you either pass them or you fail them. And when you fail them, the failures get emitted to like a GitHub issue tracker, and everybody can see who's failing what. Like, oh, this person doesn't have disk encryption, or this person doesn't have X or Y. And I really like that idea. So early on, when I actually reached out to DHH about Shipshape, and he connected me to Jeremy because he was like, Jeremy's the brains behind this, and Jeremy was really nice to just get on the phone with me and Fritz, who's our UX designer. And we picked his brain for, I think, over an hour. I'm just asking him why they built it, you know, what they would build differently if they had to do it again. And that was part of a series of interviews that I didn't do just with Jeremy from Basecamp, but we also reached out to a lot of other companies that were doing what I've found is now called user-focused security. So we talked to another person, Jesse Chris from Netflix. And they had built an app called Stethoscope, which was like a little tool tray app. And it actually like has little warnings there if your device isn't configured correctly. And they were doing that in lieu of enforcement on devices as well. And they were doing it like at the scale of Netflix. So it was like those two conversations, plus some blog posts from Jeff Belknap, who's the CSO of Slack, who he was talking about some of the bots that they had built at Slack to help for end users to help the security team like verify alerts that they were seeing. All those things kind of create this primordial soup where Collide eventually, the idea around our latest version of Collide really came together. And I can't thank them enough because it was all these little ideas kind of coming together and kind of creating some compromises there and like focusing on this where we got a really solid solution. So instead of just building a pretty UI and an open source project, we have now a mission, we have ideals, we have values that we're trying to push, and we have a well-defined customer that we can pitch to and say, you know, there's alternatives out there than just locking down all of your, you know, engineers' devices. And we think it's really awesome. So you should check this out instead of looking, just reaching for, you know, traditional device management.
That's awesome. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Chris, before we start to roll down, do you have anything else you want to ask?
I don't think so. Other than Jason, where can we find you online?
So you can find me on Twitter at jmeller, J-M-E-L-L-E-R. And you can also follow Collide at Collide, K-O-L-I-D-E. And if you want to check out the app, K-O-L-I-D-E.com.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us. I had a lot of fun. The OS query stuff, something that like always was like, as soon as I learned about it, I was like, this is pretty awesome. You know, creative idea. And it's neat to see, you know, how far you guys have come with all that. So I'm excited to try out this newer version that you guys have now. So, yeah, I guess, Jason, we will talk to you next week.
Which one of us?
Knew this would happen.
Yes, I will. I will talk to you next week, if not sooner.
Cool. All right. See ya.
Take care, guys.